Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Well, Matt, it seems like it's been a month since we've been in studio together, and I'm excited that we're both here. It makes the show so much fun for me.
It's great to be here as well, Alan, and I especially enjoyed some of the listener questions last week. And for those of you that have been listening and sending in questions and comments, thank you so much, and please keep them coming.
And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain.
While bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful.
Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
We'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family.
Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, today, Matt, we're going to discuss addiction. And, you know, I read a stat that drug overdoses in California have now outnumbered car accidents. It really appears as though we've got a true epidemic at our hands, don't we?
Yeah, Alan. And what I'm seeing at the Betty Ford Center here in West LA is that addiction truly doesn't discriminate. We are misled, you know, as a society with this idea of who the, quote, drug addicts are. But addiction really affects everyone, whether it's doctors, lawyers, people in the industry, to, you know, a 16-year-old who's struggling with depression and who's really just trying to self-medicate.
Well, as many of you know, this is a field, as far as at least working with at-risk youth, that I've spent 35 years in, and I can't think of two better guests to join us in regards to this conversation.
Yeah, Alan, today we bring in Dr. Brian Cooey and Scott Silverman. Dr. Brian Cooey is the director at the Betty Ford Center in San Diego. He spent his last 6 years working at, directing, and running treatment programs from Valley's Women's Center to Center for Learning, and now leading the Betty Ford Center in San Diego. But really the most fascinating thing about Dr. Cooey is his quest for education and knowledge in our field. Dr. Cooey continued to go back to school, getting his doctorate. He's also a licensed advanced alcohol and drug counselor, a certified addiction treatment counselor, a certified anger management facilitator. He's also holds domestic violence counselor certificates and is a certified in seeking safety and non-crisis interventions.
And our other guest, Scott Silverman, is an author, humanitarian, and fellow leader in the addiction community. Scott has run and started, quote, Second Chance, the incredible program for the homeless population and substance abuse. He recently started YourCrisisCoach.com, which I hope we'll have time to discuss more about. He has authored multiple books, including the newest one that we're here to talk about, Tell Me No, I Dare You. Aside from all of his dedication to the field, what is most fascinating about Scott is his own personal redemption story.
Alan, full disclosure, I am both a colleague and a friend and an admirer of both Dr. Cooey and Scott. And people say you're a reflection of your friends. And if that's so, I'm honored to be friends with both of these gentlemen and want to formally welcome them both to Answers for the Family.
Gentlemen, it is great to have you here. And I know that there is so much for us to talk about with both of you. But you both have such incredible stories that led you to this field that you're now working in. Scott, can you tell us a little bit about your personal journey?
Well, you know, Alan, thanks. And Matt, it's great to be here. So, you know, going back, and you know, I grew up in San Diego, and, you know, just to kind of fast forward it because of time, and I want to hear a lot from Brian as well and you guys, and the fact that you set up a platform like this to allow families to get information and share information and, you know, bring questions forward. I think it's really, you know, it's not only topical, but it's cutting edge because this, you know, this disease of denial, nobody wants to talk about. So, you know, my journey is I grew up in a, you know, middle-class family, upper middle class in San Diego, got into my own issue with substance abuse, tried to take my own life back in the 80s, got help, got lucky, and got surrounded by some, you know, real good, solid clinical support and experts. I had a lot of family support, which is rare and unusual, but that makes a difference. And I'm proud to say that I've got a little over 32 years of continuous sobriety. And I say that not to brag, but I say that to share that there's hope and there's help. And I believe, you know, with my experience, I don't certainly have the credentials, you know, Brian has or you guys, but what I have is a lot of experience, bump my head a lot. And through my crisis coaching site and work I do, I try to help families now get access to treatment and find the best and highest level of care so they can get the help that they need. So that's the short of it right there, and to get started.
And Scott, I think you bring up a great point when you talk about the fact that you're not bragging about this. You're just sharing the fact that you've been there. And I know that when we are working with some of these young people and we're picking them up and we're bringing them to a program to get help, one of the things that many of them will say is, how do you know what I'm going through? You don't understand what I'm going through. And so for them to hear from somebody that says, well, actually, I do, all of a sudden you see a change in their eyes and you now have their focus. And I think that that's huge in these situations, especially working with youth. So, Brian, can you share a little bit in regards to your story?
Sure. You know, similarly to Scott, my personal journey of recovery has really brought me into the profession. And I worked in film prior to entering recovery and obtaining my own recovery. So I'll have 14 years sober this year. And really just excited to be on the show and to see kind of the interest and how intrigued people are about this topic, because I don't think it was something that was always as openly talked about. You know, anyone else who has a life-threatening disease is generally going to be interested in finding everything out about it. And I don't think it's really been that way for addiction for many years, but I think things are changing, and it's just terrific to be here. Thank you.
You know, in talking about that, I think you're referencing kind of the stigma. And the areas that I really want to take the time to jump in today include, you know, marijuana, the opioid epidemic, AA. But really, a good starting point is where you started, Dr. Cooey, with the idea that we still have this stigma, and a lot of people that suffer from this chronic disease still do feel ashamed about them and being an addict. But do you see us as, and this is, you know, to you, Dr. Brian, do you see this in our world kind of starting to destroy this stigma and it's starting to go down?
Well, I think we've made some good gains. You know, I think managed care in the 1970s really tried to look at addiction as, you know, something that wasn't really on par with other types of psychiatric and health disorders. And so, you know, public policy-wise, you know, it's always been looked at as something not worth treating, and that prisons will take care of these people, community providers will take care of these people. But it's in the literature, along with every other illness. And in terms of how much it costs us, public health-wise, with lung cancer deaths, with hospital admissions, it really makes sense to invest in treatment. So I think things are getting better, to answer your question, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
And Scott, what's your take? I mean, obviously writing the book is a stepping stone to starting to destigmatize substance abuse. And you're in San Diego, which is a big city. Is there still that huge stigma of addiction in San Diego?
You know, it's fascinating. When I talk to my colleagues, and you guys probably can confirm this being up in Los Angeles, Orange County area, the joke we have, and we're, you know, I belong to a continuum of care of providers. We meet once a month to talk about best practices and how to really support each other. And Brian, we got to get you to that meeting very soon. There's one coming up this Thursday. But what I've heard is in Orange County, people run to treatment. You know, in LA, they run to treatment. Coachella Valley, they kind of run out of the valley. But in San Diego, people run away from treatment. So I think the stigma is still significant, you know, and I think, you know, one of the talks I give a lot is barriers to treatment. And the way the insurance industry, unfortunately, treats this disorder, disease, you know, the Surgeon General finally has said it's a physical addiction. When we were sitting here talking about diabetes, it would be a whole different conversation. For some reason, with substance abuse and misuse and what's going on right now, watching this opiate pandemic, I call it, and these overdoses going on in these small towns across the country, you know, with this fentanyl mixed with heroin, it's just scary. So you would think, you know, if truly 15% of the country has an addiction problem, and each day that addict who's impaired or alcoholic who's impaired is impacting seven people negatively, you would think that every provider in this country would have a wait list. And I don't see that happening. And then you look at the statistics around this industry that has a 95% failure rate, you know, traditional 28-day inpatient, no follow-up. That's what the science says. It's kind of intriguing when you think about it. You've got all this major need and demand for need for treatment, yet getting people in is hard. Keeping them engaged is difficult. And once people get a little better, they kind of feel like, oh, you know, I did this. Could you imagine that with diabetes? You go in, you get diagnosed. The doc says, here's your insulin, and here's what you do to test your blood sugar level. And after 5 days, because you're feeling good, you stop doing it. Well, you're going to die. So it's fascinating. We don't have that same level of urgency and desire to help people who have these behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse problems. And I think people are trying, but they just don't know how to navigate. So the fact that we're even having this conversation, in my opinion, to Brian's point, I think we've made some great progress. And I think that we're seeing more people think about making a decision to maybe reaching out and getting help than sitting at home going, don't worry, I'll be okay. I can do this on my own.
Now, Scott...
Scott, I was going to say that I really liked your analogy to diabetes. And I think that's really where the focus of not only Buddy Ford Center, but the treatment industry in general is really moving it from an acute model to a chronic model, mm-hmm. and helping people to understand this is going to be a long-term issue that requires management, just like any other chronic condition.
Yeah, and I think...
Absolutely. You know, and you hear about the programs at work. You know, the science I'm hearing nowadays, and I'm sure, Brian, you confirm this, people are talking about a minimum of 3 years and an average of 5 to really treat this effectively, to have that transformation. And when you talk to people who are coming in your doors, and I'm sure you experience, they go, oh, you know, I can't really take time away from work, you know. Okay, what about an outpatient? Oh, yeah, what is that? Oh, at night, well, I've got to, you know, poker with the guys. Well, wait a second. You know, you've spent the last couple of years trying to kill yourself on a daily basis. You're telling me you're not willing to invest 20, 30 hours every other week to try to stabilize your life, A, because you could stay alive, and B, because you could enjoy your family, and C, you could dance at your kid's wedding. So, you know, it's an interesting paradigm when you have to talk with people about this disease. So I like the idea of diabetes because it's just, it's pretty clear. It's pretty clear.
You both bring up great points. And you both, you know, been in this field for, I mean, combined 45 years, yet your treatment side and the way you're focused is different. And Scott, you've really chosen to work with very difficult populations, you know, people homeless, people that have been in prison, and, you know, in particular, people who really just don't have resources. What led you towards this population?
Well, that's why I got close to Matt. He, you know, I'm used to working with people who have barriers, so it was easy to make that connection that day at the conference. I think, you know, part of my work in back in the day working in the nonprofit world, and I've actually been out of it 6 years now. It's amazing how long I've been out of it. Part of what motivated me was, you know, through my faith-based experience, you know, our temple said, hey, why don't you come down and help, you know, feed the homeless? And I went and I did it, and I just fell in love with the opportunity. But what I really was attracted to is, why are people stuck in this social service loop? Why can't we engage people to build paths to self-sufficiency? Why does our system, and this is the social service system, which gave me a lot of experience to work with the prison system, because they're even worse. You know, the idea of we'll see you soon, you know, is a mantra when people leave prison. And so I've worked with that population. And now that I work with first responders, you know, going into treatment at Confidential Recovery and through coaching, now I'm working with the people who used to arrest all my old clients. So it's an interesting, you know, paradoxical shift for me. But I think what for me is just they were very motivated, and I just kind of started there. And I kind of evolved from that customer, and I call them customers because it was up to me to engage them and mm-hmm. keep them excited. But once they got the tools, they just, you know, their trajectory for success was significant. And sometimes people who are intellectualizers, they resist a little bit. You know, they get a little help, they get a little healthier, they feel like they can do this on their own. And I just found tremendous rewards working with others who just, you know, they were basically at their bottom. Physically, emotionally, logistically, and the community just basically said, look, these are our throwaways. Can somebody, they didn't even say, could somebody help them? Because when I came forward and said, I want to help your clients, I was told that I shouldn't do that because if I created a success for people to get out of the system, I would be hurting the social service system. So that really is what the whole concept of my book was about. Go ahead, tell me no. I dare you.
Now, the I think many of us know the statistics on people in jail and in prisons that are because of drugs or drug-related crimes is astronomical. So, Scott, if you could develop a program that prevents incarceration of rehabilitees and making them prisoners, how would you set that up?
You talk about alternatives to sentencing? Is that what your question is?
Absolutely.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, what is it, something like 85% of those people that are arrested today, it's even higher, I know, in our community, 95% of the people arrested in the city of San Diego are under the influence of something mood-altering. And I get those statistics because I'm on the Prescription Drug Task Force and Methamphetamine Drug Task Force, and I've, you know, just been involved with the gang commission for years as well, that if we gave people an opportunity, you know, that we have systems now. We have the drug court. We used to have Prop 36, but, you know, Prop 36 didn't really have the outcomes. And, you know, now we have the AB 109, which is the Assembly Bill to reduce overcrowding, and then Assembly Bill 47, where, you know, people get what's called flash incarceration and alternatives to it. The difficulty is the resources aren't there for rehab. The resources aren't there for residential. The resources aren't there for outpatient programs for long-term support. And when you talk to the providers who are county funded, they'll tell you, our customer's not real motivated. Meaning sometimes it's easier to go spend 6 months, you know, three hots in the cot, than it is to go through a 60-day inpatient program, you know, bunking with a bunch of knuckleheads that really don't want to be compliant. So it takes a level of, I think, motivation, and also it takes a level of education as well. But I'd like to work on the prevention side. And, you know, in this industry, we don't see a lot of it. In healthcare in general, you don't talk much about it. So to me, if we can find ways, and look, judges are smarter, prosecutors are smarter, the court system's more efficient from the thinking perspective, but they're so busy. You know, I used to joke that some judges they were so busy they couldn't even look up from the file they had in front of them to see that there's actually a human being with a family sitting behind them that's waiting for them to send them back to jail or prison. And that, to me, is a systemic problem that we need to find ways to change. And that's going to take education, and it's going to take, you know, motivation, and it's going to take prevention all simultaneously. And I think we have to get to the next younger generation first before we start, you know, giving up on the older generation. So we're doing both in tandem, in my opinion.
And part of what I hear you saying, Scott, really is the need. There's a big separation from people. They're the knuckleheads that aren't ready to get help, and the people who are ready to get help. And, you know, a lot of judges do the, you know, 90 and 90 days thing, and it brings up the program of, for me, it brings up the program of AA. And not to out you or Brian, but you guys are both big supporters of the program, I know. And a lot of people who are, I guess, resistant to treatment, it seems like, or people who are struggling with kind of the acceptance of addiction are the ones, to me, are more likely to fight against AA and against mutual aid groups. But do you guys, in today's treatment world, and I guess, you know, you could start here, Dr. Cooey, what's your take on, you know, talking to someone about AA or talking to a person who wants to get their foot in the door as far as the treatment world to determine whether really they do have an issue or not?
Well, you know, I think the data really shows that a person who has mutual aid support post-discharge from treatment is going to have a better outcome 1 year, 5 years later. There's no real question about that. And in terms of self-sufficiency and being able to self-direct their own recovery, you can't have somebody in clinical programs for the rest of their life. It's just not sustainable. So you're really looking at a resource that kind of revolutionized how we treat this disease. That's, you know, grown and grown. And so AA is free, NA is free. You know, the meetings are ubiquitous. They're available everywhere. And it's really helping the person to understand why it's easier to get better and stay better when you have support than it is to try and do this on your own. And I think that kind of involvement is really, there's so many therapeutic factors in AA that contribute to not just abstinence, but really a lot of behavioral change to becoming more adaptive in society and to really feeling connected to other people. So a lot of it is just kind of really helping people to understand what it's for, how to access it, and, you know, how it improves their chances of having a better life.
And Scott, when you hear people say it's a cult, or, you know, try to kind of negatively stereotype it, what's your kind of answer to that?
Well, I think it's a form. You know, I'm an AA guy. I've been involved, you know, from the very beginning. Our confidential recovery, our outpatient program here in San Diego, we're not a 12-step program. And the reason is it creates an opportunity for someone to say, I don't want to do that because. So what we do is we try to eliminate those barriers at the front end, because we know that there's other social models out there that people can get involved with. And, you know, the whole concept, for example, around I call it the God problem. I was Jewish. I was a guy. I was in treatment. My rabbi came to visit me, and he actually said to me in treatment, he goes, you know, Jewish people don't have drinking problems. And I go, wait, what? He goes, Jewish people, they don't have drinking problems. You know, we're not impacted by alcohol. I said, Rabbi, I have a wristband on. Those are alarms on the door there. That is security down the hall. And I'm in here for alcohol and other drugs. He goes, well, you know, God is within us. And with God within us, there's no way that God's going to allow that to happen. I said, look, if God's within me, I'll tell you, last week in New York, when I was on business, I had blackouts every day. God's a party animal. So trust me, God may have an issue too. So we talked about that. So what I try to do is eliminate that. And our team does the same thing, that there's something out there. And I think Brian said it. You cannot be clinically supervised the rest of your life or institutionalized. And that social model, that interaction, so important. And, you know, I think that, you know, anonymous programs are a great tool. But, you know, once you remove the anesthesia, once you remove the mood-altering substances, then all of a sudden you're left now with things that happened to you in your childhood, in relationships, and with the trauma, that doesn't get treated in the rooms, if you will. And when you bring, you know, we talk a lot about MAT now, medication-assisted treatment, in our facility, and we do a lot of it, and we're doing even more of it. And I'm concerned because I know that I deal with a lot of sober living environments, and, you know, they're abstinence-based. And I get that, and they go, look, Scott, we're not going to take somebody who's on medication for getting off of medication. And I said, okay, I get that. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of people specifically around this opiate issue, and I know the doctor could speak to it better than I can. You guys are experts in the field. You know, I'm more of a kind of a, you know, an experiential anecdotal guy. I call myself a behavioral health consultant because of experiential experience in the field of working with others. But when it comes to the clinical experts, I defer to our psychologist, and we refer out to addiction specialists, because at the end of the day, one size doesn't fit all and everyone's different. So what we try to do is really meet people where they're at. And I know Betty Ford is doing the same thing, because I've heard the senior management talk about it, that, you know, if someone's not a good fit for you, you're going to make that referral. And that's the kind of thinking I think the treatment world needs more of, because we're going to see more people if we do it that way. Because that, to me, is the way we really should treat human beings and go, look, you know what? I'm not the best for you, but let me make some referrals. And I make a lot of referrals out, because we don't do inpatient, we don't do detox, and we don't work with minors, and we don't deal with the geriatric population. So I refer out a lot because I, you know, I'm out in front of the media, and I'm open and honest and transparent, so I get calls. So I help families, you know, hopefully get the right referral, whatever I possibly can.
And I think
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. But and I think that from the standpoint of the opiate epidemic, I think we all recognize that it's there. But I think we also have a lot of finger-pointing that's going on in regards to that, and I'm probably as guilty as anybody, many of which point towards the pharmaceutical companies. So I'd like to kind of hear from both of you that if money wasn't involved in it, if the pharmaceutical companies weren't profiting so much from it, what are some of the things that we could do to attack this epidemic and defeat it?
Well, you know, I think that
I can go.
It's okay. So, I think the kind of availability of prescription opioids has really driven up kind of the incidence of opioid use problems and misuse problems. We certainly didn't see this, you know, prior to the explosion of kind of narcotic analgesic use in the 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, as the United States, we consume 80% of all painkillers in the world, and you know our prescriptions have tripled in a decade. So I think that has some part to play in it, but I don't know if blame is really helpful. I think that, you know, there's a lot of layers as to how this kind of emerged. And part of it is really, you know, not the fault of the medical community. They don't really have a lot of training in addiction, typically, in kind of standard medical training there. And because you're looking at an illness that doesn't affect the entire population, they're really looking at different kind of models of care for people that don't really consider the potential addictive nature of prescription opioids. And then you have the whole kind of segment of illicit opioid users, which some of which were actually previously prescription opioid users. So, you know, it's, I don't know if blame is helpful, but to answer the question, I don't think that we would have had this big of a problem had there not been some sort of financially driven distribution of opioids in our country. So,
Scott,
what's your thoughts?
You know, I agree with Brian. I think blaming doesn't help. It's kind of like watching what's going on with our government right now in D.C. You know, pointing fingers doesn't move the needle. A couple things. I think to the point about moving backwards, right now was a 264 million prescriptions were written in 2015. 264 million of opiate prescriptions were written in 2015. That's a lot of prescriptions. So clearly, you know, we're a pill-oriented society. And that's just in the U.S. So, you know, and the thing that's interesting, when listening to the drug-seeking conversation, when I hear doctors present, you know, at the end of the day, when you think about it, you have to be a licensed medical professional to write a prescription from the, you know, the legitimate prescription perspective. So to me, as change agents, doctors can take an immediate role once they're up to speed. And I know they're adding more information in medical school. They can be major influencers on slowing it down. You know, and I think the AMA last year and the CDC finally admitted, you know, long-term opiate abuse does not help with pain. I call that the accidental addict, if you will, the one who gets the prescriptions and have been having them renewed for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. So there's a real opportunity there because they're kind of like the gatekeepers. So they can really slow that down. The, you know, the manufacturer, clearly, look, they carved out a niche. You know, obviously, Purdue, one of the big companies. I've spoken with them personally. And, you know, they're trying to find ways, if you will, to educate the pharmacists, the distributors, but technically it's the doctors who write the scripts. I'm not blaming the doctors because the doctors took the Hippocratic Oath and they were mandated when somebody came in and complained about pain to fulfill that need with prescriptions. So we've got this interesting paradigm shift we have to have and create systemic change. You know, the doctors have to get educated. The consumer has to get educated. Families have to get educated. But again, just last year, AMA and CDC finally said together, boom. And then we also had the Surgeon General pop up with it's a physical addiction. So last year was a very interesting year of discovery and admission. So hopefully we can use that information. You know, my kids are 25 and 30 respectively. The way they look at treatment and the way they look at addiction is completely different than me, and I'm 63. So, and the only reason I'm probably sober longer than Brian is because I'm much older than he is. But, you know, at the same rate, if we keep this sobriety going and he and I are out there talking about it, you, Alan, and Matt are creating this conversation, all of a sudden it's popular to say, you know what? I'm not going to another family member's funeral. I'm going to do something about this. And as an interventionist with my crisis coaching site, I see families all the time. I've got two active ones this week, same thing, 24, 28-year-old. They can manage it. You know, oh, it's only marijuana. You know, oh, it's only opiates, you know, through my doctor. So I listen to these stories over and over again, and I hear the same barriers to treatment that I hear all the time. I paint a picture for the family, and we stay on top of it, and we check in, and eventually, because someone's helped coaching them, they get it. But if they're on their own as parents, you can't find this information on YouTube. It's not there.
No, and we're going to step out for a quick break, but when we get back, I want to address the issues of it's only marijuana. We're going to talk about the marijuana laws. We're going to answer some listener questions, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why I hate the word relapse. So once again, please stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. We are being joined by author Scott Silverman of the book Tell Me No, I Dare You, and Dr. Brian Cooey, the outpatient director of the Betty Ford Center in San Diego.
All right. And gentlemen, before we went to commercial, Matt talked a little bit about the marijuana issue now and how people look at it. So, you know, we're here in California. Now we have, for a period of years, it's been legal from a medical standpoint. Now we have just recently become one of the states to where it has become now legal for 18 and over. What is your take on this? And should parents take marijuana use in teenagers as serious as other drugs? Please share with us. Go ahead.
You can go ahead, Scott, if you like, or...
No, go ahead, Brian. Okay,
go ahead, Brian.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously cannabis has become decriminalized, and I think in the past 5 to 7 years working in addictions treatment, I've seen more people come in just for cannabis use than in the previous 7 years I've worked in this industry. So, and I think that's an artifact of a few things. I think, one, you know, the concentration of THC in the product is much higher, so it's really not your grandmother's weed. You're looking at kind of different types of products being developed to ingest THC. With youth, it's, you know, they don't really have the judgment or the sensibilities to make good choices about use and cannabis use in particular. And if you look at the data, you know, over 60% of young adults don't think that marijuana is addictive, and 1 in 9 people who begin adolescent cannabis use are going to become addicted. So, you know, I think there's pluses and minuses to it. You know, I think that it should be viewed as really a public health issue, a public policy issue. You know, I'm not against cannabis use per se. I'm just against addiction problems. And I think we need to really view it as something that is commensurate with other dangerous addictive chemicals, and that, you know, people can develop really serious issues from cannabis use. So we see a lot of depression. We see a lot of rage issues. We see an activation of schizophrenic potential in patients who have that predisposition. So you're really looking at something that, you know, particularly in adolescence, increases one's risks for all kinds of problems in the future. So, you know, I think it's a problem.
Scott, do you have something to share, to add to that?
Well, my biggest concern, and I was on a lot the other side of the debate quite a bit with 64. Marijuana was one of my drugs of choice back in my day, but it was just like, you know, hemp. It wasn't really strong. My biggest concern, and I think there are some great medical applications, and I've heard some and read some blogs about marijuana being used in place of opiates for pain or other areas around, you know, different behavioral health or mental health issues as well, and medical issues where it's necessary. And some of these studies are showing it's really helpful. And I know medical marijuana has been around a long time. My biggest concern is what I understand about the developmental side of the brain in teenagers and young adults, that when you're using this level of THC content that is so strong while you're in your formative years and your brain is still developing, that, and they don't have studies around this yet, the longitudinal or the long-term negative impact can be significant. And to the point that an individual may not even, you know, may turn into an addict, if they will, if they're predisposed, but the damage to the brain from a learning perspective can be permanent and irreplaceable. So to me, that could create some even more issues long-term that could make addiction look like something that's manageable to mental health issues that are completely out of control. So I don't know what that looks like, but I do know that young people whose brains aren't developed, who make the decision, you know, this comes from God's green earth, it's an herb, it's organic, it's gluten-free, and all the excuses that comes along with it, you know, it's frightening to me. So it's, again, it's that education of that younger person, because these are going to be the people that are going to be responsible, if you will, for guiding our lives as we get older and my kids' lives. So I err to the side of caution, but I also agree, even as an addict in recovery, that there are great places for marijuana to be used as long as it's being done in a circumstance where it's, you know, professional medical experts are monitoring it and they're, you know, toxicology labs are verifying what's in someone's system. And we're really, you know, we're doing the job. We're monitoring it, correct it. We're not just saying, go ahead. And then you watch the edible issue that's going on, and we're seeing animals now that are being subjected to accidentally getting hold of these things, and they're dying. So I think we're going to see more activity around that, because it's animals than we will human beings who overdose or do, inappropriate things under the influence of edibles. So, and that's, there's no way to measure that in the system yet. So I think we have a long learning curve, but I see what's going on with the marijuana industry, similar to what I learned happened with the tobacco industry way back in the day. So if that trajectory continues in 20 years, we're going to see some major problems in our communities because of that, you know, impairedness that comes from long-term use and abuse of marijuana, let alone the other circumstances we're currently experiencing. That's my thought.
Yeah. Now, I was in...
Yeah, and if I can echo some of that,
sure.
And some of those concerns, not to be an alarmist, but when you know, there are some longitudinal studies, and what they show is really a 6 to 8 point drop in IQ by mid-adulthood for adolescents, cannabis users. And then when regular use begins prior to age 16, on average, there's a 60% lower likelihood that person is going to graduate from high school. And that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's something that requires a lot of thought, and we still haven't learned kind of how to navigate all of this yet. So,
now, I was in Amsterdam a few years ago, and I met with the drug czar there to discuss some of their policies. And Scott, maybe if you could add something to this in regards to your opinion, but their aspect or their approach to this was, we have made marijuana legal, for 18 and over, and we have made opiates and other harder drugs so incredibly illegal, like a 10-year minimum sentence, you know, for a first-time user, that they believe that they have approached it differently and that they have less a problem than we have here in the United States, because they feel that the marijuana use is easier for them to deal with from a clinical standpoint. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I was actually, coincidentally, it's actually in my book, I spent some time in Amsterdam in 1976, and I don't know if it's still true or not, but that was the heroin capital of the world, and the reason was because of its port, and they were making so much money with, you know, their free spirits around substances that, you know, I don't know what the current policies are internationally, but I think globally, we have an expert here in San Diego who just finished as the UN czar traveling the world, and some of the recap he's got. There are places around the world that I think are doing a much better job than we are in the U.S. as far as treatment, prevention, education at the end of the day. But in Amsterdam, you know, for example, I don't know, but I know that it's still free, and their consequences, they may have changed the legislative consequence if you're under not under the influence but a possession to a certain amount, but historically they've been a very free country for a long time, but I don't think they've had the problems that we have just because I think there's other quality of life issues that we seem to stumble on. You know, the level of you know, family just told me last week, they said, you know, they actually lost a family member, and they were told that if their child had eaten dinner with them more frequently, their child would not have overdosed. I mean, it's like, really? I mean, we know that family spending time together creates a different kind of environment, but to tell a family who lost a child to an overdose that that's all they had to do differently was have their child at the dinner table more frequently. And some of the science says that that's one of the most effective tools of getting a child to communicate with you effectively. I was a drive-by parent, still am. And I'll tell you what that means on a different show. But the bottom line is, I think that globally, we're having a conversation now we've never had before, because, you know, and I even heard recently some of the large pharmas are now going offshore to distribute medication because there's not the resistance that they have now here in the U.S. because of what's happened with the morbidity rate. So there you go. I mean, to the point about, you know, business is business, but that's their business. Just like saying in Colombia, you know, we got to create a way for them to stop making cocaine. Well, guess what? It's the consumer who drives the consumption. So if you think about it, if we'd stop wanting it, would the distribution slow down?
That's a great point. And we have a listener question that has come in. And again, we want to thank the listeners that take the time to send these questions in. I know that we get many from people who are working in the middle of the day, so they send them in the night before. And again, it's much appreciated. This one reads, this is a question for Brian. As I've been reading about the great work the Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation has been doing in the area of addiction, our daughter has been fired from her job about a random drug test that came back positive for opiates. She is turning 18 in 3 weeks and says that if we try to take actions such as admitting her to treatment, she will refuse to continue on to college and will leave town and live with friends in another state. What can we do to help her?
Well, you know, just based on the age of the person described, I think you have to approach adolescence a little differently. And so, you know, really looking at kind of what's developmentally appropriate for an adolescent versus what is kind of pathological behavior. Coincidentally, at Betty Ford San Diego, we have a program here called Teen Intervene, which is basically 3 sessions with the licensed therapist, 2 with the adolescent and 1 with the family, to really get a good assessment of whether or not this person is a good match for treatment, because it's really important not to become so alarmed that you're putting somebody in a level of treatment that they're really not appropriate for. And so I think that, you know, you need to find places with good clinical sensibilities about adolescents and how to really kind of pull apart diagnostically what's happening there. And so, you know, I think that having really good, strong conversations, you know, when we look at adolescents who use, right, from about junior high to about mid-high school, the values of that person are really strongly influenced by the social environment. That's parents, that's family, and, you know, their attitudes towards using. When they're getting to about being a senior at high school, it's really more intrinsic values that are driving their behavior. So parents have a tremendous influence on their kids, and really helping them to look at, you know, what are their habits, what are their behaviors, what are the things that they can do to create really good, strong, adaptive behaviors in their kids, and to really insulate them from even having to, you know, have a conversation like that. So there's a lot of layers to that, obviously, but...
You know, and not to get on my soapbox here, but one of the really cool things about getting Dr. Cooey and Scott on the radio show together is really taking where our field is going to the next level. And I think that at this point, I think we've accepted as a community that we've got a chronic disease. And the next step really is to understand the way we look at any disease. And one of the things that in the recent weeks for me that's been fascinating is even like the terminology and the way that things are viewed and the way addiction's viewed even by the terminology. And when I think of what I mean by that is we look at the word relapse. And I'm starting to use the word reoccurrence more than relapse, because I think relapse has such a negative connotation. In fact, relapse isn't even a medical term. It's got its roots in religion and morality. But I think that when you use the word relapse, it kind of carries, and an author wrote, it's got a historical baggage, like historical baggage to it. And another terminology thing is we use the expression a chronic relapser. And to me, that sounds so much different than, you know, a person who's got recurring episodes of alcohol-related problems or someone who's struggling at attaining stable sobriety. So for us on this telephone call and on this show, as kind of trailblazers in this field, I think it's really important for, in order to change the stigma and to accept this chronic disease, that we even change the way that we discuss substance use disorder. Your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think that you're right. And the word relapse is such a pejorative, and, you know, it has its roots in religiosity and kind of moral judgments, being a lapsed Catholic, things like that. And, you know, really want to create a framework that doesn't use language that is shame-based, stigmatizing. And so when people use again, you know, that's really a symptom of their illness, and that's what they're in treatment for. And it's not a commentary on their merit as a person. And so a lot of it is, you know, modeling language that is empowering for people and that is not shaming for people, so they don't kind of fall into the trap of kind of learned helplessness.
Scott, your thoughts?
Yeah, I real quick, though, I want to go back to the other question about the parents with a 17-year-old. Please make sure they get my phone number. I want to talk to that young person and see if I can maybe point them in a direction a little different, because it sounds like they're holding the family hostage with their threats. And when that happens, I get very excited about an opportunity to do some crisis intervention, because I think that's there's a way to navigate that differently than the family should have to by being held hostage by a punk thinker who's thinking that, you know, I can manipulate my parents, and if they want me to go to college, they got to this, they got to that. But that's never going to end if they don't intervene on that in a way that's going to be positive for the outcome of the family. To answer your question, I think this. When we have an attitude, when someone drinks or uses again, we kick them in the program. We literally kick them in the program. Back in my day when I had 175 beds on 9 scattered sites, we actually ended up creating this, we called it a relapse house, where people could actually go when they relapsed, so they could get a higher level of care, because evidently there was more things going on, because they were going to meetings, they're doing what they're supposed to, seeing their clinician, talking with their marriage family therapist, but yet they were, some reason, they were getting high again. So we tried to give them a higher level of care, to Brian's point, that there might be other issues that are going on, or they might need a different level of care, maybe a higher focus, and their impairment and barriers to recovery might have just been something different they couldn't get in a group setting. So I believe it happens. I think it's part of what takes place. And I like the idea, because to me, it's kind of like a new flag in the sand. It's a tipping point, so we can deal with it. And in a group setting, you know, what I've seen the clinicians do is my attitude is, when I go to a meeting and I hear about somebody who talks about going back out and coming back in, my attitude is, that's somebody who went out for me that I don't have to worry about, that, you know, I appreciate the fact that they've come back. I've listened to their story, and that's something that I don't have to go do, because I think of them as the messenger who went out and experimented, if you will. And, you know, there's a term they call it, therapeutic relapse. Somebody goes out and comes back, and there's different terms around. I agree with Brian. Anytime we don't have to use shame-based or stigma-based language, you know, and now the DSM-5 is out, and there's all the new language about, you know, use versus misuse and abuse. Really, when you're talking to human beings, it's like, you know, look, stuff happens. Let's sit down and talk about it. That was yesterday. We can't change it. What do we need to do today to help it, you know, help you feel better and get better?
And we have,
does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And we have another listener question that has come in. This one reads, "This has been a very stressful past 2 years for me. My company is continually threatening layoffs, and I look around at the room full of wonderful people who appear to be panicked about what the future holds for them and their families. I hear similar stories from so many other people around me. Reading your book review, I can only ask, how do you feel we can turn this around?" Scott?
Turn what around? The sadness about potentially loss of job? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting it the same way you're getting it. But yes, I think that it has to do with, I think it's an overall sense of anxiety. I mean, that seems to be what we have, that's brought on by so much insecurity.
And I think it goes back to my point I made earlier. I think that, you know, we're so engaged today with, you know, electronics and the internet and texting, that we don't have that same interaction. You know, I know as a family, I try to put my foot down when my kids are home, just, you know, take a half an hour just to check in. And I think, to their point, that if you're in a situation where you're not feeling like you can manage what's going on with your feelings, and so that's a hard way to put that, but sometimes you need others to give you that input, it's good to make a phone call. So if somebody's anxious about, you know, losing a job, or they work around it, I mean, because that was my specialty, was helping people with barriers to employment for decades. And these are people with, you know, on parole, with barriers, felony arrest records. And my attitude is, if you can fog a mirror, I can help you find a job. And I believe the only thing that I can control in my life is my attitude. So sometimes you just need to talk to a life coach. Sometimes you need to talk to a therapist. Sometimes you need to make a phone call to your faith-based leader, a friend or a family member, and just say, look, these are the magic words: I need help. Sometimes just being able to say that, I need help, it's amazing what can happen in your world, versus trying to figure it all out yourself. And that's one of those things. We hit the wall, We all need to get help somewhere in our lives. And if you can figure out a way to say that, I need help, my guess would be you'll get it. It may not be the best, but you'll keep trying, but it'll change the way you're looking at what's going on in your world. That's the way I would recommend someone take a look at that.
And I don't know a better close than to have just that. The key is we need to all recognize that we need to ask for help. Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for coming on, and I want to acknowledge the fact that you are out there, you are working with people, you are saving lives, and that is something that we're thankful for. We're thankful for what you're doing for the next generation. I mean, we're literally making a difference. And again, I want to thank you so much for doing that. For everybody out there, if you want to get more information in regards to Brian and Scott or in regards to the book, you can go to yourcrisiscoach.com. You can go to confidentialrecovery.com. You can also go to hazeltonbettyford.org. If you're driving, obviously you can't write these down, or if you have trouble spelling these, you can go to our site. It's answersforthefamily.com. And you can get all the information there. We'll make sure we've posted it so that, if you have any additional questions, and especially the person that sent in the particular question about the 17-year-old, if you go there, we will have Scott's information so that he can talk directly to you. Matt, again, thanks for being here. This is great. I'm so much more pumped up when we're both here in studio and having great guests. It just makes it that much better.
It is great to be here, and I love the opportunity I got to chat with two people who I really respect, and to get to do it with you, Alan, it's always a pleasure. And please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we're joined by Roy Damone, author of I Bully, The Serious Consequences of Cyberbullying. And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word.
And be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.